Welcome to the DoorDig Studios, Creative Women in Conversation. The DoorDig Studio is a not-for-profit house museum with a gallery and sculpture garden. It is the former home of Slava Horovitz-Doldig and her husband, sculptor Carl Doldig. The DoorDig Studio holds a nationally significant collection of sculptures, artworks, furniture and archives, which tell the story of this emigre family's journey from Europe via Switzerland and Singapore to Australia. The DoorDig Studio aims to inspire creative journeys through the telling of this story and through its public and education programs. This series of talks is inspired by Slava's inventiveness and interests. Our two creative women in conversation will explore influences, ideas and stories in the creative process. Welcome to Creative Women in Conversation number 8. This week we'll be talking about the creative spirit. Our speakers this week are Monique DeMartina and Fiona Gruber. Monique DeMartina is a singer, songwriter, composer, pianist and mother. She also teaches jazz piano and songwriting at the Victorian College of the Arts in Melbourne. Monique divides her time between Melbourne and New York and is well placed to talk on creativity and the challenges facing women in the creative arts field today. Fiona Gruber is a journalist, radio presenter and writer. She writes regularly on the arts for Australian and British newspapers and magazines and produces and presents on the ABC. Between 2001 and 2011, she presented The Opening, the arts show on PBS FM. Through these activities and innovations like Gert's Sunday Salon, awarded a Green Room Award in 2005, she contributes to the debate on the arts and Australian cultural life. Welcome, Monique and Fiona.
Thanks very much, Jenny.
Well, yeah, I think that given that Monique can't keep her hands off the piano, there might be a little piano musical interlude before we almost go.
I think we're going to just, you know, like bend our heads in prayer and prayer.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I should say that when we met last week, I came in and Monique had just walked in here and sat down at that piano without saying anything to anybody and had started playing Chopin without knowing that Slava, that was her favourite composer. And I believe you're going to start off by just
So I thought I'd start with some Chopin. So was it Jenny or Melinda was telling me that Slava, who was so talented and inspired and inspiring, she made a choice at some point in her early years. It was music or art, and she went the path of art, but she always loved music and to play, and particularly Chopin. So here's a little. It might end in a bit of improvisation.
Excuse my back.
Thank you.
that was wonderful. Thank you so much. That was an absolutely lovely start to the conversation. Now, Monique, what was your earliest memory of when you knew you loved music, or your earliest memory of music?
Oh, it was very early. My grandmother gave us a piano, my maternal grandmother. And it was just always there for me. I was a bit of a bookish... I was bullied in primary school. I was a bit of a bookish kind of loner in the primary school years, and the piano was a place to run to.
And was your
horrors of primary school. Of the playground, yeah.
And were other members of your family musical?
Everybody, yeah. My mother played beautiful classical piano, and my father played kind of boogie-woogie style, and all my brothers and sisters played some kind of music, but I was the only one fool enough to turn it into a profession.
And, well, I mean, it's always a great start, isn't it, when you have a family that's behind you that understands what you love.
Yeah.
So presumably they were supportive of your decision to study music full-time.
Yeah, it was not their first choice. They would have rather I finished my law degree. But yes, absolutely, been very supportive always of seeing that it was my love, and it really was. There's never been another one. I've been quite faithful.
You weren't like Slava. You weren't torn between painting and music, or I don't know.
I wasn't even torn between
skiing
music and
at the Olympics
law.
Or something.
No, not skiing. Not certainly not law. No.
You're well known as a jazz composer and singer. When did the jazz bug sort of enter your life?
Quite late in terms of how it usually rolls out, because I was a classical pianist at school, and the first couple of years at uni I did classical piano at the Con with law. And then I just thought it was the most amazing thing to possibly be able to improvise on the piano, which I couldn't do. So I was about 20 when I started the whole improvising caper and crossing the floor to jazz.
Yes, because I always found that amazing. You know, being a bad pianist myself and noodling around a bit, I totally full of admiration for people who can just sort of, you know, take a tune and then just improvise it and play with it and keep up with other people. And, you know, you see it, all these people improvising together and going, yeah, and, you know, you think, how do they do it? How do you do it?
Well, it's a language. You learn, just like you learn to speak French, or, you know, you're pretty quick on your feet with words. It's just like that.
But so you said you know, your classical training, which doesn't really encourage improvisation at all.
No. It was pulling teeth in the beginning. It took me fully 10 years of practicing many hours, like, you know, 5 to 8 hours a day through my 20s. It's how long it took me to get to start sounding good in the improvising realm. No, it's like learning another language, and probably trickier one than French, I would say. Yeah, so it was really difficult for me because of the way I came, because I didn't come through Suzuki, which is ear-based. I came through learning to read, which is read music. It's just like learning to type, really. It's you have a relationship between the music and the visual and your fingers.
There's like a muscle memory almost.
Yeah, but it's between the eyes and it's that schema and the fingers. I had to relearn it and rewire it to the ear. So that took me pretty much the whole of my 20s, I'd say.
And did you put away music, you know, stop reading music to help you improvise? Would they kind of like one mess around with your head too much?
No, I actually was able to keep it because of, yeah, I need to play Bach every day or I go a bit mad. So I had to know, I just kept them going. They do complement each other. Mm. It's like reading in French and speaking in French. They do, it's not like French and Italian, which don't go together at all. Too close, too confusing.
So who were your influences when you decided to embark on a jazz career? Who did you turn to? Did you have mentors here? Did you, any teachers, any people who really inspired you?
Well, weirdly, probably the two pivotal mentors that I've had musically have been classical piano teachers, but ones who had a great respect and understanding of the whole improvising jazz gig. But there was Donna Coleman, who was the head of keyboard at BCA at the time that I was studying my master's there. And then she put me on to Sophia Rosoff, who was her teacher in New York. And Sophia passed actually just in December last year, at the age of 94, I think. She was a Yoda-type character in the jazz world. Many famous jazz pianists in that work the traps today learnt from Sophia.
Because it's quite unusual to have women in the jazz. It's a very masculine world, isn't it?
Yeah,
still
very much so. Actually, the music industry, full stop, is the statistics are incredible. You can't believe that.
I can.
11% of all the royalties that APRA pays to women to composers in Australia go to women. 11%.
That is so small.
It's horrifying. And it's even smaller in the jazz realm. Yeah. So it is interesting. Most of the big names in jazz are men, but my biggest inspirations have been those two women, I would say. Musically, of course, in terms of the language, a lot of men: Louis Armstrong, Jelly Roll Morton, Bill Evans, Ray Charles, lots of men. There are not so many women instrumentalists in the...
Yeah, I mean, some of the early singers that we know, you know, were very proficient pianists and musicians as well.
Yeah.
You know, like some of the greats, like Billie Holiday and Ella Fitzgerald, and they were very proficient, weren't they? But they were pushed into...
singing.
No one wants to see a chick behind the piano. They want them up there by the microphone with a glamorous dress.
Yes.
This seems to be the logic historically, doesn't it?
And Lil Hardin, Louis Armstrong's second wife, she was the one who, I mean, if it weren't for Lil Hardin, who played piano in his band, she was a fantastic pianist, but she put her efforts into marketing him. And she was the one that kind of dusted him off and got him a great suit and said, smile this way, hold your trumpet, take the photo, market. The Hot Fives and Sevens was all her design. Uh-huh. She produced that whole venture. There's no, you can't take anything away from Louis. He was a star, but she was the one that, in the very beginning, set him on the road to stardom. There are lots of stars who we don't hear about because they didn't have a Lil Hardin. You know, so she was really the one that set him up to make him famous. And then the marriage fell apart and he went on to great heights. But she was a fantastic musician in her own right. But it's just interesting. That was the choice she made in those years. It was a good 10 years where she was putting all her efforts into supporting him.
Well, it's a very familiar story, isn't it? So who was pushing you when you were a younger musician?
I was pushing me. There was really no other... It just was something I had to do, and it was annoying and inconvenient too. It would have been easier to finish the law degree and get a solid income and, probably have... It was annoying too because the thing I wanted to do... I'd always been good at things. I could get marks easily and get into the course I wanted to get. Everything academic came easily, but not this jazz piano thing. I had to really, work to the bone, and still it didn't sound any good, and then wake up and keep working. It's just annoying that the thing I happened to want to do was something that I wasn't naturally excellent at. I had to really work hard.
Oh, but do you think it's partly because if something comes easy, you don't care about it as much? That the fact that you had to really stretch and work to get there musically?
Yeah, I value it more now. I love it because I've worked for it. You know, I don't think I would love it so much. You're right.
Now, tell us about your New York years, because you studied at the Con, and then you started moving into jazz piano, and then you got a Fulbright scholarship.
Yep. So this was when I was doing my master's. So I did the jazz course at BCA after the classical thing at the Con, and then I... I enrolled in Masters at VCA, and I was doing my Masters on Wynton Kelly's sometime pianist, not Miles Davis's pianist, Wynton Kelly. So that's when I got the Fulbright scholarship to go and study in New York.
That must have been fantastic.
It was pretty cool.
Did you find out about the Fulbright yourself? Did someone put you onto it? Did you?
Donna Coleman put me onto it. She came here initially as a Fulbright.
Right.
So she said, you should apply for this. Bless her.
And what was it like? How old were you when you got to New York?
28.
So you were, you know, you were mature. So you weren't sort of like a shivering 19-year-old, but
no.
Still massively different. Had you spent time in New York before?
I'd been there, but this was the first time. I'd travelled quite a bit and on my own, but this was the first time I'd lived somewhere else, lived other than Melbourne. It was fantastic. It was permission to actually stylistically put everything down and start with a new slate. And it was fantastically freeing that nobody knew me. So I didn't have to be good at this or...
And had you been gigging here before?
Yeah, I'd been gigging here quite a bit. But I didn't... I was still very formative. My style, everything was still really coming together. And I was very raw about it. So it took me quite a while to find my musical legs. And I found them in New York, I'd say.
So where did your legs take you to? Who did you want to see? Who did you want to hear? Who did you want to be introduced to when you got there?
Well, I got smart because I was on a student budget and I wanted to go and hear everyone play, but it was $30, which was a lot in 2000, to go hear someone. Plus then you had to buy a drink, and if you wanted to hear them, you know, three times a week, that was really not going to work out. So I got a gig as a waitress at the Top Jazz Club, and that way I got to hear them all for free and get paid to hear them all. So, and the tips paid really well, actually. I highly recommend it. So that way I got to hear, over a two-year period, everyone that's sort of working the scene. Anyone who's anyone plays at the Vanguard at some point in the year. So I got to hear some of the real old greats like Clark Terry, Tommy Flanagan. I got to hear all the kind of new guys, Brad Meldow and Paul Motion and everyone. And that helped me crystallise what I was into, which I discovered because I'd come into this whole venture from classical piano. The things that interested me were these more modern guys like Keith Jarrett, Chick Corea, Bill Evans, with this very complex kind of harmonic language, but it was too complex to begin with, and I didn't realise that. So what I found in New York was a way of building my house with bricks and having the foundations of simple blues and simple song forms.
And was there ever a moment, you know, as you in all the best films, you know, where you put down your, you know, you're in your waitress gear and then you kind of go up to the piano late at night and you start singing, they'll go, oh my God, the waitress is a jazz singer.
Yeah. I wasn't singing, so I couldn't have, but I did have I had a few little, yeah, with some cool cats. Yeah, there was a bit of hanging and Wynton Marsalis, I got to play with him.
That must have been pretty good.
Yeah, that was great. And Jimmy Cobb, Miles Davis' drummer.
Wow.
Yep. But I was more heading in the direction of songwriting and away from actually jazz instrumental world. Love it as I do, but my thing turned out to be more songwriting influenced by all of that stuff. But, you know, not so much the jazz expression where you play solos for 20 minutes and send everyone to sleep.
So when you were writing songs, were you thinking of singing them yourself or were you thinking of writing for other people?
Well, I started out just as a pianist, and so I was writing songs because I couldn't help it because they kept coming, and then I would give them to people and I just couldn't get them to do it right, so then I had to start singing, and that was annoying too because I really was not naturally... I didn't, you know, I'd never had one of those voices that everyone said, oh, you must sing. In fact, my brother said, don't ever sing.
Brothers said...
Those awful brothers. Yeah, but I'm... Just like the piano, I just had to roll my sleeves up and work at it a bit to get it ship shape.
You know, I think it would be great if you sang something now, actually, at this juncture, and then have a little bit of chatting afterwards.
Yeah.
Just to give us an idea, because you were talking about a couple of songs earlier. Which one would you like?
What one like? I'm feeling like just something random. What shall I do? Let's see what the piano says. I'm going to sing a song which has nothing to do with what we discussed, right?
There
so
you
this
go.
Is this is a song that I wrote on the radio for a woman that rang up. Sometimes I do a song in an hour on the radio. Listeners call in with a song idea and I go off and bespoke the song and come back and play it in an hour. So this was one of those songs. Trish called up and she wanted a song with a kitchen metaphor about a train wreck in love. So this song is called No More Coffee in the Coffee Pot. If I can remember how to play it. No coffee. Yeah, that's it. No more coffee. Oh, this is it. No more coffee in the coffee pot. The sugar's on the table. The stove is still hot. I see what you are and what you're not. Not in my coffee pot. No more honey hot buttered toast. You had your thrill, now you're just gonna move your way on up the coast. I was cooking up a Sunday roast. Now you want it in the post. No more sugar, no more beer. Should have known it, it all end in tears. No more coffee and no more cigarettes. I should have known it's about as good as it gets. I could have made a bet. Sure as coffee is wet.
Fabulous.
A bit fast, isn't it?
And where have you sung that?
Oh, I've sung it in Rome. I've sung it in Wangaratta.
Well, great jazz festival at Wang.
It's great. Yeah, it's a good scene. I've sung it in Perth, all over.
So it's part of your repertoire.
Yeah.
How How big is your repertoire now?
Gosh.
How many songs can you remember? Because that was really interesting watching you going, oh, no, that's it. Oh, and getting the chords right and then
yeah,
going,
yeah, because I actually haven't
bang.
Played that song, I'd say, for over a year, but it just is the one I felt like. Look, hundreds and hundreds of songs. I could play for a week and not repeat.
And is that normal for a jazz composer, a singer, a performer, just to have that much inside you?
Yeah. I happen to have a good memory. I can hold a lot of lyrics. I'm lucky. But in the jazz tradition, it's an oral tradition, so you carry it all here.
Yeah.
And it becomes your friend and it pops out. It's a fantastic thing, really, because each song is a different little friend. You're never bored because you can go in, pop into lots of different places in your head.
So it depends what mood you're in.
Yeah.
So you were in New York and that must have been a fantastic experience. So you were there for several years, weren't you?
Well, yeah, it was 2 years in the beginning and then I'd had this 10-year period where I kept flip-flopping between here and there and travelling, doing other spots too. I was in China for a while and Europe. So about a 10-year period of jumping around and then 2 years again at New York.
And then you partnered up.
Yes, in New York and my first daughter was born there. And then when she was still a baby, I moved back here with her. Yeah.
Was that a big culture shock coming back to Melbourne?
Very. Yeah. Yeah.
And do you think it was coming back to Melbourne or coming back to Melbourne with a baby?
I think that, yeah, all of that. And Melbourne had changed, so it was sort of... In fact, I did an album at that time in the first year after I came back. I wrote an album of songs that were all... It was such a... Everything was in Technicolor. Nothing felt familiar. It was like, oh, it's like, you know that Ray Bradbury story where they go back in time and they change the butterfly? They change everything because someone steps on a butterfly back in the past. And then they come back to the future and everything's kind of the same but kind of different. It was sort of like that. It was really... Disorienting.
And was the jazz scene, was it better? Was it?
Yeah, better. It gets better and better all the time.
Well, that's good to know, because clubs come and go.
Yeah.
And...
Now, that's an excellent thing. In fact, now, because I've been back 9 years now, I would say it's even better and actually just as vital as the jazz scene in New York.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, don't forget about Sydney, not on the map.
Really?
Nothing happening in Sydney.
So Melbourne is the capital of jazz.
In fact, not just jazz, of live music. There was Music Victoria did a census. The figures came out. Did anyone hear just a few weeks ago? Melbourne is the jazz, not just jazz, the live music capital of the world was the...
Really?
That was the result of this... study in terms of number of gigs happening, attendance at gigs, and number of venues. We're really lucky. We've got and there's always more popping up. It's because we've got, well, poor old Sydney. You've got to feel sad for Sydney.
You do, but you know, I'm sure that many of us, you know, we're swelling with pride at this moment. We're thinking, oh, Sydney-Melbourne rivalry, we win yet again.
Yeah.
You know, but of course, if you're a gigging performer, you want other cities.
You
want there
to
be a circuit.
It's a shame because, you go up to Sydney and there's nothing there for you. It's a real shame. But Perth's great, actually.
Well,
I go to other places to play, and the regionals are really great for people love their music to get out in, you know, Bendigo, Ballarat, Castlemaine.
So, yes, because there's a lot going on in the regions. Now you've got two children.
Mm-hmm.
And you're single again.
Mm-hmm.
How do you manage?
I don't manage, Fiona. I really don't. Can't you tell? I'm just like...
Let your dresses on the right way round.
On the brink of absolute collapse at any moment.
Well, when we were talking earlier, and you really seized on something that Slava said, where she said, I've never worked so hard in my life.
Yes.
I'm not quite sure what she was referring
over
to.
Here.
It's just over here, though. that quotation.
Yes.
And you said, I so relate to that.
Yeah, it's hard work. Being a mother and being a musician isn't just being a musician. If you're a musician, you have to be an administrator, a publicist, a copywriter, an educator. Educator, just only in that you're dealing with human resources and human... There's just... You have to have your finger in so many pies, which I happen to enjoy. I like the diversity, but I... There's too much. It's just the workload's unbelievable. It's not natural.
And what about that? I mean, obviously, your children are what, five and...
Five and nearly ten.
Yeah, so they'll grow up a bit. You'll be able to... You're hoping that you'll be able to get back into it by much
get
more...
Get them on the admin.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That is a great idea.
Yeah. The 10-year-old's good with home tech. And if we can just move that into...
Well, surely you get on social media.
Publicist.
Yes. Memes.
Yeah.
Monique memes.
Yes, all of that. Yeah. If I could get her to learn some graphics software and she could... Yeah, that sort of thing. It's just... life has become very fast. But it's interesting to see. I'm sure it seems that Slava felt the same when she was teaching, doing her own art... Supporting Carl doing his art, I think.
Bringing Eva up.
That's not an inconsequential aspect. That's it.
Actually, Eva, it'd be interesting to ask you: Was it a traditional relationship between your parents that it was seen as normal that your mother would maybe sublimate her career a bit to support your father, or was it just a more practical decision?
I think it just arose in the circumstances, and there was just a need to earn more and to support the whole family, and she saw herself as another means of actually supporting the family, and of course my father had no objections to it. It just happened, and it was really had to happen in their instance, because they had to struggle from midlife, sort of more or less 10 years ago in your time, starting all over again.
Yeah.
You know, and that was so much on them, so much responsibility.
Yeah.
And then I was always there. I had to be careful.
Well, yes, and of course, but you're the one who's carried on their legacy, so that's rather wonderful. And Monique's training her children up to do that as well. So, so Monique, you teach as well?
I teach at the College of the Arts and at the College of the Arts Secondary School. Piano, improvisation and songwriting.
How many women, girls and women, do you have in your classes? What's the percentage?
I would say it's about 20% in the jazz course, which is a little up on when I was there.
Do you have a message? Do you talk to them, to take them aside, try and help them a bit extra, to give them advice as women in still a man's world?
Yeah, I do. It's a funny thing. I would say this across the board generally, although of course it doesn't apply to every individual, but when they come in at age 18 to 20 to the jazz course, generally the boys have more confidence than their skills deserve, and the girls have less. I can confidently say, and I've taught there on and off for 20 years.
That's really interesting.
I'm just always trying to build the confidence of the girls and get them to be happy to make a mistake. That's the big one. They're just so scared to mess up. But you can't make any omelets that way. You've really got to let yourself mess up on the road to getting robust in your art.
Well, so, I was talking to a former head of the VCA School of Art, and he said he actually, when he took over, he set up a studio in the middle of the school precisely so that students could come in and see him do bad art, make mistakes, chuck stuff away.
Yeah, great.
Because that's the only way you're going to grow.
Yeah, that's it. But for some reason, the perfectionist ogre infects the girls more than the boys. There's a lot of study on it. It's not just my...
It's not just music. It's in
No, that's right.
So confidence inspiring. So
yeah.
Where do you want to... This is our final question, because I think we're coming to time-wise. Mm. But so where do you want to grow into? You've got kids at the moment, you know, it's a bit of a struggle.
Yeah.
Though you're looking and sounding fantastic, which is
bless
good.
Bless you. Thank
where
you.
Do you see yourself in 10 years' time? Where would you like to see yourself in 10 years' time?
Well, I want the children happy and strong and on their way, and I want to keep growing as an artist. And that's, I think, why my radar brought me here in the first place, that I could see, you know, we're all different personalities. I happen to be one that has to have the big picture making sense to me all the time. So I always felt from quite an early, I guess by mid-teens, I'd decided that the whole point of being here on the planet was to grow. So this whole endeavour, songwriting and making music and sharing music, it's a forum that you can always grow in. And so I just want to keep working in it, keep growing and keep making music.
Well, that's pretty good. That sounds like a very good aim. Now, I think you're going to end our conversation by singing something.
Yeah.
Is it possibly one of the things we've discussed? Or have you, while we've been talking, decided on something else in that improvising tradition?
Well, I think it's good, this one. I think we'll do it. Because in the spirit of moving forward to the future, because it's actually a song I haven't... Apart from... I did a TED Talk, and I played this song on the TED Talk. Apart from that, this is a world premiere of this song.
Well, we're very...
Right?
We're very honoured.
Because it's going to be recorded in the album that I'm working on at the moment. So, this song, it's called Chords Without Words, and it... In the narrative, it's a mother to a child, and the mother gives the child these chords as her legacy. There's no big pot of gold or grand tracts, vast tracts of land in the inheritance. It's just these chords that she's nutted together, and she thinks they sound nice, and that's what she's giving to the children in the hope that there's a spark there that they can work with. And the chords don't have words, so it's up to the kids to write the words. Oh dear, we've got a little microphone issue there. Just everyone avert your gaze for a second. Will I? Oh. There we go. Okay. My darling, I give to you these chords, chords without words. They are yours, picked up off the ground. From the day I found them, they have stayed ever near. In the warm of my ear, hung out on a heartstring, now I give them over to you. Keep them all together, they're not clever but they're true. Chords without words, flight without a bird, heart without nerve, fourth without a third. Shell without a pearl, love's vow unheard, a babe waiting for its birth. My darling, these sounds can be your swords, and they'll serve you well, but first they must be burnished in the tight through the dark and lonely night. You will find them, name them, and baptize them. Chords without words, flight without a bird, heart without nerve, fourth without a third. Chords without words, shell without a pearl, love's vow unheard.
you so much. That was absolutely wonderful. I think we all feel completely sort of emotionally charged and delighted. Has anyone got questions? Any questions for Monique?
Gina.
I was just wondering when you said when you were in your 20s, you were practicing in 5 to 8 hours a day.
Yeah.
And you're now also teaching at VCA. What is it that is in you and that you also see in your students that pushes you through that? I mean, it's an incredible commitment. What is it that makes you do that?
It's very addictive. I think, well, how long have you got? I do think that music is our highest vibration. I mean, we all know the good feeling of laughing with friends. We know the good feeling of feeling warm and sated. But music takes us even up beyond that. I think of a tree and the roots are in the ground. Once it's got its sustained, essentially, the roots are solid. That's us having our homes and enough food and the children are safe. That's how we've got our basic requirements set. Once that's set, then it can really start, you know, happening on the top with all the finery, shall we say. And that's music, I think, that it's what we get around to if we can. It's our highest hope. That's how it works for me. Yeah, I think it does for most of us, even if we're not aware of it. In fact, I'm reading a fascinating book at the moment and I cannot remember the name of the book, nor that Andrew someone. My mother bought me this book. Thank you, Mother.
I don't know.
You don't know. She doesn't know half the good that she does. Yes, she has given me so many books. Anyway, he's a guitarist, a present time guitarist in New York. He nearly died of pancreatic cancer and then made a miraculous survival when his wife, he was just about to go, and his wife put earbuds in his ears in the ICU and played the St. Matthew Passion. And that was the moment, medically speaking, where he turned. And he returns 3 times a week now that he's well to play classical guitar to the patients in the ICU in New York. And he's got... it's just routine. He watches their vital signs. Blood pressure's the first. He starts playing and the blood pressure goes down straight away, predictably every time. And... you know, I just think it does us so much good. It's the answer to most things.
I have a question.
Eva.
How do you see it in the schools now? We've got 2 young children. I don't know which school they go to, but
yeah,
obviously recognise what's going on or observe it. Can you see some progress in music education, in art education at the schools? What is your...
Oh, it's pretty grim, I think. Yeah.
That's my worry.
Yeah. I think the Steiner schools have got it right. They focus on art early and they don't even get kids with doing reading and arithmetic until they're about 8 or 9, and that gives them... You know what, even I was just noticing my 5-year-old had a couple of friends home from school yesterday. They went straight to the table and started doing art without speaking. That was just natural to them to just, you know how kids go, they just do it. They half an hour of just busily, before we even talked about food or drink or anything, that's just their natural mode. And then they pick up the instruments that are hanging around and they start playing. They live in that realm of making art. The school system, the government education system, doesn't have a hold on that at all. It is. It's awful.
Go easy. I have a question.
What's your strangest source of inspiration when you found something that's inspired you?
Yeah.
I'll
tell you, well, strange, this isn't so strange, but I'll tell you what I'm currently thinking about, which is really fascinating me, and it's actually... since I came here for the first time 2 weeks ago, and and I've been thinking about making art in, you know, I've been thinking about Slava and Carl and how their art obviously was the thread through and propelled them forward in their lives. The Raja tapestry. Anyone heard about the Raja tapestry? I'd never heard of it. So I just found out about it earlier this week, and I'm writing a song around it. It's at the National Gallery in Canberra, and it's a tapestry that was done by women convicts on the Raja ship.
Oh, yes.
I'd never heard of it, and it's the most incredible piece. And that just really touches me, that it's so beautiful and the conditions they must have been in when they were putting it together on the ship. Yeah. That's what I'm thinking about now. So I'm working on a song around that.
And what was the toughest thing you've ever had to contend with in your creative process? The thing that you nearly didn't succeed with?
Self-doubt. Yeah. It's very hard to make it work economically, being a musician, and particularly being a single mother musician, it's incredibly difficult. There are lots of ways you can stop making art and make money, but I just can't stop doing the art, so I have to find a way. I'll just die if I don't do it. I'm a terrible person. I'm a horrible mother. I just lose all my mojo. So I have to do it. But now I trust in my art. But in the beginning, in my 20s, that was a terrible period for me because I was working so hard at it, but I didn't really believe I was going to get there either. It was a very sort of dark time in a lot of ways because I didn't sound any good.
Did you think you didn't sound any good, or were people telling you didn't sound any good? Because you might have sounded good and just...
I think I must have sounded good to some people because they gave me that scholarship, right? Mm-hmm. But I didn't rate what I was doing at all. Now I enjoy my music. I listen back, I like it. I like to listen to it. Back then, if I listened to anything that I did, it was so excruciating, I couldn't bear it. I couldn't listen through a whole recording of my own music. So, I don't think it was all the music. That was the hardest thing, my own wrestling with my own demons.
So that's it for this week's Creative Women in Conversation. Thank you to our wonderful speakers. If anyone would like to know more about the Dooldig Studio, please go to our website at www.dooldig.org.au. Thank you all very much.